Hello, my name is Gail Mowat, and this is The Muse. My guest today is the Armstrong British Columbia artist, Frances Hatfield. Frances Hatfield was born in the Okanagan to a pioneer family that emigrated to Canada from the UK. She graduated from the Vancouver School of Art, now Emily Carr, with additional studies at the Ontario College of Art and Okanagan College in the Fine Arts program. She has taught at many different places, including Kootenay School of Arts, Okanagan School of the Arts, and Elliott Lake Summers Art School in Ontario. Frances has delved within various aspects of the arts, such as weaving, painting, and pottery throughout her artistic career. Frances Hatfield was amongst a few pioneers within the ceramic world within British Columbia. The first potters in British Columbia were mainly immigrants after World War I and II, whereby they brought their established craft with them. There had never been an Indigenous ceramic culture in British Columbia until that time. Frances Hatfield was amongst this small group who located or created resources where none existed. Amongst this group of potters and artists, she also sought out internationally renowned ceramic artists to learn from. These instrumental artists created a supportive, vital community whereby they made themselves known within the art community in British Columbia, and they aligned themselves with ceramicists worldwide. In a reciprocal fashion, many innovative artists have been supported, developed, and nurtured by artists like Frances Hatfield. It's because of potters or artists like her that there is a ceramic culture today in British Columbia. You were born in the Okanagan to a pioneer family. Talk a little about your family and how they came to the Okanagan.
Oh, yes. Well, I certainly heard the story from my mother. She said that when my father proposed, and they were in Cheltenham in Britain, in England, he said to her, "You know, my mother is a very possessive and very strong person, and I'm afraid she's going to run our lives unless we get away." So it chanced that I gather he had a cousin in Australia, and he thought maybe that's what they would do. But his mother had quite a social circle, and one of her gentleman friends at tea said, "Edward, I hear that you're thinking of looking elsewhere than Cheltenham." "Right," said my father. "Well, I've just bought some property in a place called the Okanagan. It's an orchard. And I've been casting about wondering if I could find someone to take a look at it." My father, presumably, I don't know how he was going to Australia, but he immediately thought, "I can cross Canada, take a look at it, and then go on." However, he took a look at it and decided to stay.
So where in the Okanagan was
it? It was south of Penticton, okay, on Skaha Lake, which in those days was called Dog Lake. So my mother came out and they married when she arrived in Penticton and settled there. And my father ran the orchard, liked the life, decided to buy for himself and plant. And that's how we stayed. We didn't stay there. He moved farther up outside Kelowna.
And did he have more land there? Is that what he continued to be an orchardist?
Oh, yeah. Yes, he did. Well, he had studied horticulture because his sister died of TB, and he was, as they used to say in Victorian terms, he was threatened with TB and told to live an outdoor life. And so that predicated the whole outcome. Mm-hmm.
Beautiful.
So we were brought up here instead of in Cheltenham. And I had a cousin who used to constantly say to me in Britain, "Oh, what a pity that your father went away." And I said, "Stop saying that, Tom. I am so happy to be a Canadian. I don't necessarily want to be an English girl." No.
No, of course. Well, and it's such a liberating life in the Okanagan in comparison with, like you said, the Victorian confinement.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, in
yes.
comparison to a Wild West one.
Especially in my age group, Kelowna was only about 5,000 souls at that time. It had wooden sidewalks. If the sidewalk filtered out at, where would it be? A little bit east of Ellis Street today, before the United Church in there. The sidewalk just ended. That was the end of town.
And I guess where all those, you know, all the big malls and that, they would have been orchards at that time.
There was nothing but orchards. Yes, the Pridham Orchards were where the Orchard Park is.
So what kind of home did you grow up in? Was living outside very important to you? Or?
Well, it was important because of my dad's TB thing. So he built a house that was a little bit unique. It had sleeping verandas and eating verandas on all four sides. So the house was like a nucleus with all these screened verandas. And we literally slept on the verandas from the moment you could move out when it wasn't too cold until it got really cold. The whole family, the two daughters.
Right. Well, that's very much like in the architecture of Australia. They have that sort of premise.
They do, yeah. Yes.
I've never seen it out here in Western BC.
It wasn't. Well, in those days, Kelowna had a lot of mosquitoes.
Okay.
They did. They had down where today it's the co-op and the railroad tracks and all the industry was very swampy. And it was very mosquito-y. They used to spray a very fine oil on the ponds and swamps. And gradually they eradicated, I think, the mosquitoes. We never had them up on the benches, but yes, it was a good thing to have screen porches, really.
And then to have the cool air at night, too,
oh,
for sleeping.
Wonderful. Yeah. I immediately screened part of this veranda when I moved here, so that I've always continued to use a screen porch in summer.
Well, it's almost the true Canadian experience, isn't it? Like, rather than having a cottage, you make your home an indoor-outdoor place, right?
Mm-hmm.
When and where did art making really start to become part of your life?
As long as I can remember.
And was that because of your mother or your father's influence? Or?
My great-aunt, whom I didn't know, because after all we lived out here, we would go back sometimes, but I really didn't know them in the real sense. She was a painter, and I have one of her small paintings, as it happens. Other than that, I don't have a sense of connection. My mother was extremely good at anything like knitting and sewing, and I think had she been given a chance, she might have moved toward painting, but then a pioneer lifestyle, and they married in 1910, didn't leave time for much.
There's no time for that, for sure. Everything is about just getting your basic needs met, right?
You got busy and made a living. And there was no art gallery, not then. There was no library.
So how did she adjust to, that's such a different world.
She loved it.
Did she?
She just loved it.
Because she's coming from Great Britain, which would have been all museums and all sorts of things like that, and then to come to a place where none of that existed for her.
But she just fell in love with being an outdoor person. Had a horse. They had horses. In fact, in the beginning, she drove the sleigh, a little sleigh with the horse before the cars. And so she totally adjusted very quickly.
Well, I guess she had no choice, really. It's survival of the fittest, isn't it? I think we all figure that one out. What clearly motivates or drives you in respects to your art making?
I can remember very early trying to make pots, thinking that, well, I like making things a lot. And I even tried firing them. Somewhere I got the idea about firing, and I put them in the oven, but that didn't work, in the wood stove. And then I tried putting them in where the wood was put, but of course they blew apart.
All right.
So I was very early, I was into doing, as my mother said, I used to say, no, I haven't time for lunch, I'm too busy always doing painting or potting or something. So from a very early age...
You just found clay and you thought that would be...
Well, I found something that it was... Well, there were pockets of clay around. It was near enough that I could coil it up and pinch it up.
Little pinch pots, yeah. Those are fun to do, aren't they?
Oh, I loved it.
Yeah, there's just something with the dexterity and the sort of fiddling with them.
And it's such a... It's so malleable and it's... I was going to say comforting, but I didn't really need comforting. But it's a very comfortable thing to work with clay or with wool. Later on, as an adult, I did quite a lot of weaving.
So, okay, what kind of mediums did you... You started off with pot making, and then what did you gradually... Did you continue doing pottery?
When I went to the art school, the Ontario College of Art, I had it in my mind that I would go into what they called interior architecture, which was a kind of highfalutin form of interior design or decorating. However, once I went through basic and tried all the things, I realized that I was not going to be comfortable going to tell people how they should decorate their houses. So I listened to our history of art teacher. She was very wise, and she said, you know, many of you want to be painters, because that was then my next thought was, I'll be a painter. She said, it's not going to be easy. You'll probably end up teaching. Well, my dad had been very eager for me to go to UBC and become a teacher, as were his two sisters, both in Britain. He said, it's a nice life and it's decent life for a woman. You're intelligent and so on. And I did not want to be a teacher. So when I listened to our history of art teacher, I thought, I think she's right. If I really want to stay with art in some manner, I better be practical enough to use it in a way that I can find a living. So then I turned to the pottery.
And is that because at that time pottery is functional art? Is that why?
Well, there was only one potter in British Columbia.
Okay, that's a good reason.
Mr. Ebring, the Vernon Potter, the old gentleman. And then afterwards there was another named Lambert. By the time I'm on the scene, Ebring is the only one. So I was very early on the scene learning to be a potter. And actually I found that that was something that the Ontario College of Art probably saw as a kind of stepsister. They really didn't put a lot of emphasis like as they did on sculpture and painting, so that the teacher was very unprepared, which was a disappointment.
For your request to do clay.
And we were veterans. We who, in the group I was with, this is how we turned up there. We were veterans of the Second World War.
Right.
And taking our credits, as they called it. You could take credits in land or in education. I'm not sure. I don't think they paid out money, but you could do those two things. And West Bank, between where the ferry used to go, the shore, and leading toward the town, was all orchards, too. All veterans. So a lot of veterans did take up land and plant, but I thought, here's my chance to do art some way. But as I say about the... lady teacher. She was so afraid of the gas kill, she wouldn't fire it.
You were a veteran of the war. Were you in the Army?
I was in the Air Force.
Air Force, okay. Mm. And so you, how many years were you in Europe when you were there?
No, I was too young. They wouldn't let you go overseas unless you were 21, and I joined up at 19, and so I couldn't go much as I wanted to. At any rate, that's how I got to have the opportunity, because my father would never have paid for me to go to art school. He was dead set against it. He thought it was a very frivolous notion.
Even though you were going to be a teacher in the end, right? Really?
he was not happy about it. So I was able to go. At any rate, strangely enough, because we were older, we were veterans, not youngsters out of school, we could really see what we were getting. And the people with me in the pottery felt the same way, that the lady was not experienced enough. So we, three of us, accepted an invitation from someone in St. Andrews, New Brunswick, a lady named Helen Mowat, who was a most amazing lady. During the Depression, she had been very aware, I suppose she had some money, she was very aware of the straits of the people, that they were so poor. And she noted that women still had looms from their mothers or grandmothers, but they didn't use them. So she took herself to New York and studied how to weave, came back and taught them, and started a weaving industry. And then she thought...
Was this in Cape Breton? Was that where she was, in Cape Breton?
In
Nova Scotia?
Nova Scotia. And then she thought about the men. So back she went to New York and learned to pot and set up a pottery. And these two things were going very, very well when the war broke out and the men left, but not the women. The women carried on, and in fact I have a woolen pullover that was knitted by some of the weavers. And the men just left and the pottery fell into disuse. So she contacted the school and asked if there was anybody who might come down and restart it. And one of us was a Nova Scotian. He said to my friend and myself, would you take a flyer on this? Come down and start it. Then, if we were lucky, maybe we won't go back to the college. So we said we would. And down we went. I married a member of the, one of my fellow students, and he went back to Europe to work for the United Nations. And so I was sort of at loose ends anyway. So down I went, and of course, jumping right in feet first, having to do it, is a very different story. And we did. We got it going, which when I look back, I marvel, because between the three of us, we didn't have that much knowledge. But Miss Mowat was still alive and very interested, of course. And in that summer, by sheer chance, we went up to see a very noteworthy pottery couple in New Brunswick. And we visited with them. Their name was Dykman. And incuriously, they had two daughters who were mad about dancing. And I happened to see them on the lawn and they were dancing around. And so I joined them because I had had quite a lot of ballet training. And they stood there amazed and said, you know how to do that? And I said, yes. And they ran for their mother and they said, we have to keep her. And so her mother, the mother asked me what was I doing? And I told her and she said, would you consider being our apprentice? You know we're making a living. They made beautiful work. And we would be really happy because then you could teach our daughters dancing.
Yeah, what a nice arrangement then.
So I did until finally it was feasible to go overseas and work with displaced persons, as was my husband doing. So it was a roundabout way, and I never went back to the Ontario College.
Well, you had no reason to go back. You knew that you were...
I knew that. Yeah. I don't know whether they closed it down. I did know that the lady teaching it had been a very good friend of the principal, and I think that's why she had the job.
Oh, I see. It's fortunate that she was horrible at it, that you would go somewhere else.
Well, it was.
Yeah.
Because I got a good grounding with being an apprentice.
So did you have a name for your school that Mrs. Mowat had set up? Was it just something that was...
No, I just did it as a private person. Well, I called my Pottery Pine Hill when I moved up to the Okanagan. Up here I have a great collection of pots from many, many people. So it's almost...
it's exquisite.
It's a collection that starts with the Dyckmans, so that's late 40s, and it comes up to not that recently, 15 years ago. So it has a long span, and I recently had help to wash them, dry them, and then I put the name of the potter, location, and so on, because I thought it could be an interesting collection, maybe for a museum.
I think it would be a very interesting collection.
But in time, as does very often happen, I got back trouble. That's very common with potters.
It is, yeah.
And so I switched back to painting and then went on from there.
And so, and weaving, you did at various stages?
Weaving was a very handy interval in which I did weaving because we were moving quite a lot. There was no way I could set up any pottery, but I could take a loom around. And I wove and actually sold work, woven work. And then that gradually went into the bank for the day when I would have a pottery and I would get the equipment.
So saving up a little nest egg for your pottery equipment, right?
Yes. Because pottery equipment, even if it's relatively simple, is not cheap. So that's what I did. Then I had a youngster to a daughter. I also opened the first real handcraft shop in Vancouver, and it was in Kerrisdale. And I understand that it was the very first, and that's almost 60 years ago.
So was it a working shop where you would have a store in the front and then you potted in the back?
No, I used a loom. I kept a loom in it.
Yeah.
So that I could be doing something useful, as well as looking after the shop. And I had people like Heinz Laffin and Wayne Gann, who had been fellow students with me. I had their work and many very good potters' works. And so it was quite successful. But again, my husband wanted to move, so I handed it to my sister, who was not in any way a craftsperson or artist, but had a very good business sense. And she parlayed it into a shop on South Granville that was a gift shop. So it worked out okay.
My goodness, so you just moved on. And so where did you go from there after having that shop? What was your next step?
We went over to Vancouver Island, and he was working over there.
Mm-hmm. And so what were your artistic endeavors on Vancouver Island?
I was still weaving. Mm-hmm.
So where would you get your yarn from? Did you just purchase it as wool and then you carded it?
I did take up spinning, but I never took it up very, very seriously. There was a very good shop in Vancouver which sold looms and sold supplies. So I got
and yarns
through
too.
Them.
And what sort of things did you make? Did you make tapestries or was it...
No, I did skirt lengths, I did napkins, placemats, shawls, depending on what I was using.
Yeah. Well,
I wove myself a coat, wove my sister a coat. In fact, I actually painted on the warp, which is today quite commonly done. Don't think anyone had thought to do that at the time. But because I had been exposed to painting and done painting, I thought that would be rather fun.
Yeah.
Paint the warp and then use a colored weft and see what happens. So I made my own draperies that way.
You did go to Vancouver School of Art.
I went there afterwards. Once my daughter was enrolled in public school, I thought it might be just as well to graduate from somewhere. And that's when I met Heinz Laffin, Leonard Epp, Wayne Gann, a group of us, and Kipling. We were all students together.
And having that collective, it's a pretty strong collective.
Yes.
Probably key artists from British Columbia at the time.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
And Mick Henry, another one. Chris Gufrida. Yes. And then I got to know, when I moved up to the valley and my husband and I split, I got to know the Schwenks in Penticton and other people who were beginning to take it up in the valley.
That's what I'm finding, that there are a lot of clay artists that are from British Columbia, and they're dispersed all over the province. Like Denman Island is a little haven for potters. Salt Spring also has some of that going on, too. But it's very much part of the history of art making in British Columbia.
I taught in the Kootenay School of Art, too. Had the ceramic department, so I know some of the students still who are scattered about. And interestingly enough, Lisa Murray, who's with Caravan, very interested in pottery, was asking me about potters, and I began searching my mind for the ones I knew in the valley. And I came up with a pair of ladies in Summerland who were doing it early, and Ebring, of course, whom I got to know as much as you might get to know Ebring. And
you're laughing there. Is that because he was a difficult character, or...?
Oh, he was marvelously eccentric.
Was he? Okay. Because I don't know anything about him at all.
Well, he was a most interesting creature. He had no time for women who thought they could make pots until the day when I happened to say I had been an apprentice of Dyckman's. And he looked at me and he said, "You mean Kel Dyckman?" I said, "Yes." Oh, I'm impressed.
And it took a lot to be impressed, for him to be impressed. Wow, that's stunning. So you stopped him in his tracks. So did you became good friends after that, or?
Well, Ebring never, well, he may have had good friends. I think he always had a reticence. He was Swedish. He was eccentric, there was no doubt. And he drank quite a lot. Pottery Road is named for, that's his, where he had the pottery.
Okay.
On the edge of Vernon.
I can see you've traveled a lot, too, as well.
I spent quite a lot of time in Mexico. And then, of course, I lived in Austria working with the displaced persons.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that must have been a very difficult role to play.
It was.
Because I've heard other stories about that difficult time.
Yes.
Like, no one talks about after the war and how you made sense out of it.
And it was still
quite
a shambles over there.
I can imagine. Mm-hmm. I don't know how they were able even to walk across the street, let alone try to find their homes.
And then people who'd been displaced, say, from Hungary or from Estonia, there they were over in Austria. And then now what? Would they go home? Was communism too scary? It was all tremendously involved.
It must have been, because, what can you go back to?
Nothing.
Yeah. And it's not like we can connect with people like we do today. Technology allows you to connect. Back then, everything was by post or telegraph. And
they were all kind of herded together into what had been, in the case of my husband, we were still together then. He was running a camp, which was in a very fine buildings because it had been used by Nazi officers. And he had 5,000 Jewish people under his care and command. You can imagine how tough that was, because they came from all sorts of terrible backgrounds, terribly affected. The people I worked with were not Jewish. The Jewish people somehow were together in groups. And then the non-Jewish were kind of assorted elsewhere. So mine were Russian, Hungarian, Estonian, Latvian, Yugoslavian mainly. And interesting, I also worked with young children who had got somehow dislocated from their families. Some of them had been taken in by Austrian people working on farms, and then were discovered, I mean, the war ended. So they were gathered up into what we called orphanages while we looked for their parents. And one of the things I did, along with a social service worker, was to visit the orphanages. She was, I suppose, more than anything, looking after their mental health. And I was doing whatever needed doing, including teaching them art for something for them to do. And years later, we're up at Kamano, which was related to a big project in Kitimat for the big aluminum company. And I was walking by a river, the Kamano River, and a young man was panning for gold. And I've never seen this done, so I just quietly stood there and watched. I don't think he even knew I was there at first. But he went on, then he finally stood up, tipped it, and then he saw me, and he looked, and he said, "I'm Gott, Frau Hatfield." And I said, "Yes, who are you?" "I'm one of the children you did art with." So many years before.
And he had come to Canada.
He had emigrated to Canada. He was now a man.
Oh my goodness.
And I thought, how extraordinary that we would come upon one another, and he'd never forgotten. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm sure it impressed him quite a bit. I mean, to have art must have been such a thrill.
It was, it was so out of sequence with what their lives had been.
Yes.
Through the war.
Yeah.
To be just given materials and help to just do whatever they felt they needed to do with them.
Well, so many lost their childhood, right? There was no childhood for them. And so...
No, and then, of course, then there were the parents on the other end coming to stations where all the records were kept to learn, is there any possible trace of this child with this name? It was an astounding effort, really, in so many directions.
My goodness. Yes, crucial. Crucial work to be done, for sure.
And there still is, you know. I mean, there are more displaced persons today than ever before. And it just seems endless.
Can you talk about some of the key instructors that you had throughout your life? I mean, sometimes as an artist, we take courses, especially, you know, we see a teacher or someone seems to be knowledgeable about something you want to understand better. Like, I understand when you lived in Naramata, there was a mural that was built by you and two other artists, and you knew nothing about mural making, but you thought, I know someone who does, and then you sought that person out, and you went and took a quick crash course in mural making. Is that true?
Uh-huh. Well, the Naramata Fruit Co-op had a very big facility down there in Naramata, right on the lake, and that's where they did all the processing and packing and so on. And all of a sudden, I don't think they had, to my knowledge, made much contact with people in the village before they suddenly bought a beautiful home and garden and an old church and raised them. And this had been a sort of focal view of the village, just looking up the lake. And people were furious and horrified. And they were really angry. And this building was put up 60 feet long, 35 feet high, just cement slabs, one after another. So I looked it over and I thought, this is awful. It's tearing the village apart. I'm doing pottery at the time. And I thought, well, something could be done about it. So I talked about the idea of doing a community mural. And some of the women thought it was a really good idea. So I wrote to several, and it turned out to be men in Canada who were muralists. And I said, I would be prepared to apprentice myself to you at no expense to you. I will do whatever you need done in order to learn the techniques. Nobody wanted a female. A friend in Vancouver with whom I talked about it and said, I just picked up a magazine called Ms., M-S, and there's a very interesting article about a woman muralist in Los Angeles. I'm going to ship it up to you, or you buy one for yourself. Anyway, I got one. And sure enough, here was a woman, a Mexican-American, and she was doing murals with young people who had had a bit of a clash with the law, but were not going to be jailed. They were under surveillance, you might say. So there was an address, so I wrote to her, and I told her what was on my mind, and right away I got a reply, and she said, come whenever. I'm starting a mural in the First Unitarian Church of Los Angeles, an old church, and they have got money together, and they want a couple of murals done showing their history. So I wrote back and said, I'm coming.
Beautiful.
And I did. And I joined her, and she had a Japanese girl, too. And that's how I learned how to do a mural. Well, I had asked two of the local artists in the area if they would participate. And when I came back, they said they were kind of interested. I said, well, we have to find funding. Oh, we won't need funding, they said. We'll just go and get some paint from the hardware store and do a big graphic. And I said, that's not going to answer the problem. The problem is people are missing this place. You've got to put something of the history of this place back on the wall. Neither of them would have anything to do with it. So I wrote to Canada Council, explained my idea, said I had gone and taken training at my own expense, and I got a small grant, and I went to work, and that's how it got done. And then I invited the community to come as they felt comfortable, and I had the whole thing gridded, so it's like paint by number. And my second husband was there every day helping.
Yeah.
He loved it.
Yeah. Extraordinary.
And it got done 35 by 60 feet.
That's huge.
It's huge. It was huge. Fairly recently, as I understand, the building was raised. Now, there was talk about trying to save the mural, but I don't know. I didn't hear. But it withstood the weather and everything that came at it for 20 years.
That's a
pretty... So it was painted the way it should be, not with something from the hardware store,
right,
which wouldn't have stood up.
Yes, of course, like the original people thought they should use, right? Yeah.
So it was done, and the village loved it, and people did participate. They didn't have... And I didn't blame them. They didn't want to go up the scaffolding, so
yeah.
I did all the high part, and they did the lower. But it was a very healing thing for the village.
Mm. And what was the imagery on the mural? What was it? What was it comprised of?
It was composed of the church that had been torn down, the seasons of the orchards, and series about women packing in the packing plant, and a bit of the lake, and the kind of boats that would have been common early on in the Okanagan. So it covered quite a span. And then low down, because there always would be vehicles, we didn't paint the mural to the ground. We kept it up about 10 feet, went from 10 feet on up, and below it had the running history lettered, and the names of people who helped. And it was very, very notable, because I don't think, I know there was no mural as big as that in the South Okanagan for a long time.
And I know that Vernon has a lot of murals
put
up.
They have.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, she's done a terrific job.
And so that was sort of something after that effort.
Much later.
Much later.
Yes.
But that, I've never seen that in another area where I've traveled, where murals are very prominent, and Vernon definitely has that feel.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So to me, it seems you're not afraid of the unknown. You will take on a challenge as exciting, whatever the endeavor or whatever the exploration. For example, is it true that you built your own house, including a pottery studio in Naramata?
Oh, I did.
Did you?
Because I had taken on a builder whom I discovered really was hopeless. So I thought, well, if a hopeless person like you can build something, I surely should be able to build something. I've made my own clothing. It's just that, only much bigger.
Yes, just different materials, and you learn how to hammer and nail and whatever.
And a plumb line.
Yeah.
Oh, it was a very amazing adventure to do that.
So you had a plan, and you, instead of having the builder do it, you decided just to get rid of the builder and do it.
But then I got help with framing, got trusses, as they call them,
right,
that go up into the ceiling or into the roof. Things like that I had done commercially and then brought in. I didn't do the plumbing or the electricity. And, of course, it astounded every man who came nearby, because at the time women really were not doing that. So they had lots of comments. But both plumber and electrician were very admiring of the thought that a female would take it on.
Why not?
Well, why not? Subsequently, there are lots of women doing carpentry. It isn't thought to be so odd.
No, but I think you need to... you're breaking barriers at that point.
Yes.
I mean...
And so, well, I was pretty strong on feminism at the time.
What effect do you think British Columbia has had on your art making?
It has probably had less than Mexico.
Because I was wondering, because I know with your travels that you did go to Mexico quite a bit.
I spent... about 11 winters in Mexico, and it's very hard to say what it is, but there is a kind of sense of life about that country that is entirely its own. It is, to me, far more different from Canada to Mexico than Canada, say, to Austria, or Canada to France. The cultural background is so complex and so different. And then the result of this is a tremendously rich culture, and just the coloration of people and the clothing they want to wear, everything about it has a vibrancy.
It's like a celebration, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
Like, it's almost like they're celebrating life, because the clothing they wear, the food that they eat,
just everything about them. I found it so stimulating, so exciting. I would still be going if I could.
Yeah.
But I'm too old.
Yeah.
Latterly, I went to San Miguel, and the altitude is about 6,000 feet, and I began to notice it. And then I did get pneumonia twice there, which wasn't great. And subsequently a heart attack.
But obviously, I think that's the key thing for most artists, is that you need to take yourself out of your environment. And in the new environment, it almost makes you more aware of the other, I guess.
Oh, yes. And a person who had a great influence on me was Jack Shadbolt. He was our drawing teacher in Vancouver School of Art. I found him a marvelous teacher. And he made you sharpen your seeing very much.
What sort of things would he tell you?
I remember very well one day he said to me, "You have a lovely line, but I want you to say more with it." He said, "Clench your fist. Now I want you to draw that fist so that it's like a mountain. It's so strong." I remember him doing, he came and said this, and I just thought, wow, you're right.
Powerful words, too. Like, I mean, it's just his descriptive
power.
He
was very articulate.
Yeah.
Very. He was a wonderful lecturer. To me, he was a great, great painter, but he never got...
the acclaim.
Never got any kind of acclaim in the East. They never gave him a big show in the National Gallery. Nothing like that.
That's unfortunate, because obviously he was a very influential teacher, mm-hmm. as well as a very important artist, too.
Oh, my, yes.
Yeah.
Thank goodness Vancouver owns a good many pieces. And I knew his wife, quite not intimately, but I knew Doris, too, just through my connection with the art gallery in Vancouver.
So you were at such the crux of all those important artists from British Columbia.
There was a lot happening.
There was a lot happening.
Gordon Smith, B.C. Binning, oh, so many.
Mm-hmm. I think it was just almost like a haven for those artists. They seemed to attract each other. I don't know.
Well, they were part of a movement which was West Coast architecture, painting, ceramics was getting going. Yes, it was a real movement which was very integrated. It was pre the big photographs of Jeff Wall and all that, much ahead of that. But they laid, Arthur Erickson, they laid the framework for a West Coast way of doing art and a Western outlook. And then, of course, in Saskatchewan, Greenberg came from New York and affected them a lot. So the West has its own particular art, and I don't know why it is, other than Emily Carr certainly has been accepted in the East, but somehow the West never quite got the kind of recognition I think it should have.
I think everything is of its time, too. Sometimes it's not accepted at that time, but maybe 100 years later, it comes to fruition for them, which is unfortunate for the people who are the ground-making artists doing that. Can you talk about the direction you are taking in your art-making right now?
Well, of course, it's slowed down.
Yes.
Quite a lot. We can take a walk into the living room and you'll see the kind of work I do. At the moment, I have said no to small galleries that have always sold my work, because I've said I'm too uncertain, really. In a few weeks, I'm 90, so you can't really expect you're going to have a big turnout of work. And then in August, the Federation, the North Okanagan Federation of Canadian Artists, is having a show in Armstrong. And last year we had it in Salmon Arm. And that, at the moment, because the tulips are out, I've taken on tulips.
Oh, good. That's a beautiful thing to do. Yeah.
In working on some.
So you're working in painting in this case? Are you working on painting?
Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so what sort of size is easier for you to work with?
A size that I like to work is about 18 by 24. But I had a big one right here and I just had the house painted. So I've moved it and put that wonderful one of Catherine Hahn's there. But you'll see one of my big ones out here in the patio. I like working big, but now it seems as though it's just beyond me.
Yeah.
I don't have the energy to do that.
And so you have to, yeah, clock your time. How much energy you can give a piece per day or whatever.
Well, I used to, well into my 80s, I was doing at least 4 hours a day. But now it seems as though there's always something turning up that inhibits my getting out there. But it's not really all that much. Maybe if I'm really lucky, 2 hours.
Mm-hmm. And that's beautiful that you're able to do that. So you have a studio space over here?
Right here.
And so is that winterized, that you can go out in there in the wintertime as well? Or?
Well, I actually moved myself into the living room during the winter because I thought, even though it's right near me, it can be very slippery.
Yes.
To go out there, and then to keep it all heated, if I'm really not spending much time, move stuff in. And so I did into the living room and just moved it out a week ago. Now I'm back out there. Feels right.
Feels right. Well, I think, because it's, you just leave it, right? You come back to it and you just continue. But if you bring it into the house, it's harder to work around.
Yes.
You always tidy up.
Yes. Yes, I found it was not as satisfactory as I assumed it would be.
Are there any artists that interest you at this time? Do you find new artists that are coming up through the shoot? Are they of interest?
Because in winter I don't drive now. I have almost no opportunity to go, say, into Vernon. If I get into Vernon once in a month, I'm lucky. So I'm losing contact with what's happening, really.
That's the key thing for an artist, is to always see new work, isn't it?
But I do, I get Canadian art, and I keep up in those ways. And I think my son-in-law felt if I got really familiar with the iPad, I could start bringing up images of other artists, which I haven't quite mastered yet. However, I've learned how to send email.
That's kind of exciting in itself, too. And I think we all learn different ways. Our lives are always changing. And so we always, you know, some of us can't travel, and so we find other ways. And for me, too, I also go on the internet and I'll visit art gallery spaces and look at what the artists are doing. Because I can't get to Vancouver. You know, I just don't, that's a luxury to me to go to Vancouver.
Salmon Arm has a very nice gallery.
It does.
Building-wise, it's delightful.
It is.
And the people involved in it are wonderful, too.
No, it is a very, it's a good artistic community.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And some very fine artists right around there.
And I'm finding that the Okanagan itself has some of the most amazing artists from all different walks.
Yes.
You know, some that have grown up here, some that have moved here recently, but they're all calling it home.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. What a change.
It's changed a lot. What words of encouragement would you like to share with our radio audience who may be an aspiring artist or a deflated artist? Some of us, you know, as art makers, get really low, get a low sense of our skills, and we need someone to boost us up. Do you have any words of wisdom to make one continue?
I think you need to be driven by the desire. And if you're not, forget it. It is important to really want to do it. Not because, oh, I need a pastime. No way. You're not going to go anywhere that way. You've got to have that inner urgency to want to express yourself. And that's so whether it be voice or visual or whatever. Without that, you're never going to. You might become proficient, but there's a difference. So Natalie Goldberg, the Zen lady who teaches writing, says, sit, walk, write. And I say to myself, right, you know, get out there and do it. It's no use talking about it. Just get to it and do it. And if you don't, find something else. Don't waste. If you have a talent, make use of it. Don't throw it away. But don't blither about doing something just because, well, maybe I should take up painting or take up something. No, don't. It isn't going to satisfy you unless you have a tremendously strong urge to do it.
I've been your host, Gail Mowat, and you've been listening to The Muse. I've been talking with Frances Hatfield, a visual artist from Armstrong, British Columbia. She is currently represented by the Tumbleweed Gallery in Penticton, British Columbia, and the rental program at the Vernon Art Gallery.